From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today, we're going bananas. I'll give you some surprising news about America's favorite fruit. It's Beer Week here in L.A., and we're drinking some flavorful new brews. Naan. I'll teach you a new technique for making that delicious Indian bread at home. And what's the most important ingredient in the kitchen? Michael Ruhlman's back in the studio with the answer. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Sasha Alcher, who is the chef at Street, Susan Feniger's wonderful restaurant that features street food from around the world. And Sasha, you're going to be doing a special menu for an all-vegetarian vegan menu at the restaurant coming up this Tuesday. So tell us about what the origin of that idea, where that came from, and what you're going to be preparing.
Okay, well, it is a 7-course menu. It's all vegetarian, and every option is available vegan as well. And, you know, it really came from, it wasn't as much customer demand as just kind of the way the restaurant is moving. You know, we do a lot of requests for vegetarian and vegan, and we do that on our regular menu. But I think what we really have started seeing is just this love of vegetables happening. I think people lose the word vegetables and the word vegetarian a lot, and we think of it as healthy, you know, bland food or a plate full of leftover vegetables that people put together from the rest of their dishes.
Right.
And so we really wanted to focus on a menu that really exemplified the vegetables that are around and the produce that's around. And I think also kind of fall, people tend to let go of vegetables a little more because they think it's not summertime, there's not anything out there. So we really wanted to highlight a lot of really fall harvest vegetables. So yeah, we're excited about it.
So when you say vegetables, we're talking about everything probably from squash to turnips to root vegetables to...
We have a roasted endive gratin that our vegetarian version has a smoked cream that binds the whole thing, and our vegan version has smoked potatoes that bind the whole thing. But it's all about the endive, really, and the smokiness matching with the endive, and that combination is so delicious. And we just wanted to show people there's all these ways you could eat vegetables that are so different from the way you would usually have it.
Sounds like that's a delicious sauce to go on it, too. Smoked sauce to go on an endive? That sounds fabulous. So aside from the smoked endive, what's another one of the dishes you're going to be preparing?
Well, I'm actually looking across the farm at McGrath Farms, who we're getting all our squash from. We're making a wonderful harvest squash soup, and we're doing it with Balkan flatbreads, which is a really thin flatbread that's got lots of, like, candied roasted peppers on it, and it's delicious. And with the squash, it's just a fantastic combination.
Well, that sounds fabulous. And this is going to be at Street. Tell us where Street is.
Street is at 742 North Highland. It's on the corner of Highland, just north of Melrose. And you could always find out more information at our website, which is www.eatatstreet.com.
That was Sasha Alcher, and she's the chef at Street Restaurant, and she is going to be debuting a wonderful 7-course vegetarian vegan tasting menu this coming Tuesday with fabulous treats from around the world and the market. As Sasha was talking about McGrath Farm's wonderful winter squashes, we're now talking with Arturo, who works for McGrath Farm, and he's got a whole array of gorgeous squashes up here. The one that's the most striking, Arturo, is that green spotted one with the long, curvy neck. What is that?
Well, that one is called speckled swan gourd. That's the name, and that particular squash, and people use that one for decorating.
It's beautiful. Now, if you take that home and just leave it on your table till Thanksgiving, will it look exactly the same, or does it start fading?
They look pretty much the same for the next, I say, 2 months, but after the 3rd month, when I be turning, they'll be brown.
Because right now, they're just absolutely amazing. Really striking.
Yeah, they look beautiful right now.
Yeah, they
do.
Yes. And talk to us, too, about these. They look like pumpkins. What are those?
Well, I got, like, 2 different kind of cooking pumpkins. I got this one here. They're called Winter Delight. Those chefs love it because they make a great pumpkin pie with those ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that one, the other one over there called, that's hard for me to say, but that's a Rue de Trompe, like a French variety.
Uh-huh.
And people like it. That's a cooking pumpkin, too.
You also have, you know, the standard, the butternut and the kabocha, those other wonderful winter squashes as well.
Too, yes.
And the red curry,
and
too.
Red curry, yes.
Oh, these are great. Beautiful, too. And you can leave them on your table till you're ready to eat them.
Oh, yeah. They last a long time. They last months.
Months.
Yes.
Well, this is very inspiring, and they really are beautiful. So thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Arturo, who works with McGrath Family Farm here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. And he really has a gorgeous fall display of pumpkins, squashes, and gourds here at his booth. So you can get them and you can keep them all the way till Christmas as centerpieces and then eat them. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Sasha's braised endive gratin is on the Good Food blog. For details on Street's herbivore like never before dinner and a glimpse of the all-veggie menu, go to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Farmworker issues are really coming to the forefront of discussions about our food system. In fact, Texas Republican Representative Lamar Smith has just proposed a bill that would require farmers to check all new hires' legal status. It's called E-Verify. How would such a bill impact our local farmers? Paul Wenger, the president of the California Farm Bureau, joins us to offer his insight. Paul, can you explain how E-Verify would work and how it's different than what is currently mandatory?
Yeah, currently when someone comes to work on our farms, you have to ask them for some ID, a Social Security card, and some kind of a picture ID. That could be a driver's license or it could be an ID card. And then they're supposed to have what's called a green card. It's basically a work permit that they get. The last time that these green cards were issued was 1986. And so we've been 25 years now with no way for folks, especially from Mexico, to come here and work unless they come through the H-2A program. So as an employer today, someone comes, if you're looking for someone to pick your strawberries, workers come to your place of employment, your ranch, your farm. You look at the Social Security card, you look at their picture ID, they fill out what's called an I-9 form. And you have to chronicle everything that you've looked at and put the numbers down, and then they go to work for you. When you take from their wages, when you take out their Social Security and their taxes, FICA, and send it into the government, a lot of times you'll get a mismatch letter back saying that the name and the Social Security number doesn't match. But that can sometimes take a year or two. And in fact, a lot of times the person is no longer working for you. So it's pretty much it's not real time, and that's what E-Verify bill was all about, to make it that within 3 days you have to go on the computer, you plug in the Social Security number and the name, and within 3 days you have to do that, and the government is supposed to respond back to you telling you whether that name and that Social Security number match.
Now, you mentioned that the green cards haven't been issued since 1986. Do you mean a particular kind of green card that only pertains to farm laborers?
Right. Yeah, it's for farm laborers. We have programs today. There's a H-1B program where Silicon Valley can bring in high-tech workers to work over in the Silicon Valley. There's also what's called an H-2A program, and currently it's the only way to bring agricultural workers in. It's something you have to do through the Department of Labor. It's very structured. You have to know ahead of time how many workers you're going to need. You have to go through a process asking for those workers, identifying them. In Mexico, most of them are Hispanic workers. You have to provide airfare for them to come into this country, or transportation costs at least. You have to have housing for them. It works really well for about 40 or 50,000 workers. That's about all that's in the H-2A program currently in the United States, where the demand for farm labor is somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5 million folks. So H-2A just does not work, especially for our specialty crop industries. Today, people want fresh fruits and vegetables, and you need to have workers that can really move with the harvest and move with the seasons, usually starting in the south part of our country and moving to the north part.
Yes, specialty crop is what the government calls the fruits and vegetables that we actually eat.
Absolutely, and it's today what we want everyone to eat. That's what we grow here in California. We grow over 300 different commodities in California, anywhere from, I mean, you talk about herbs and all the different commodities, but most of those are fresh. They have to be picked. The hand-to-eye coordination that is required to pick a fresh strawberry, it can't be harvested with a machine. you want to go to the store, or you want to go to the restaurant, and you want to have a fresh fruit or vegetable, it needs to be picked by hand.
You know, people often refer to this kind of labor as unskilled labor. Would you differ with that? Do you think that it takes actually a skill to be a good farm worker of specialty crops?
Absolutely. It is skilled labor. Is it hard work? It's hard work. You know, I'm a third generation farmer. I have two sons farming with me now. We grew up doing that. When I was in high school, we had a local berry farmer when you could still go work for somebody local and you didn't worry about all the labor laws that you have today. But when you got home from school, you went and picked boysenberries, made a little extra money. But you have to know which berry to pick. And when you're talking about a strawberry grower, a farmer will have invested about $20,000 an acre into their strawberries before they've picked a berry. And when it comes time to pick, you need someone that really knows which berry to pick because they're ripening at different stages. So you want that berry that is just at the peak point of where they can pick it, get it into the basket, and get into the market.
On average, what is the percentage of undocumented farm laborers that are working in California?
You know, we don't know, but we would imagine it's got to be at least 50%. The problem we have, and we have been saying all along as an agricultural community, we need workers out here. We've worked with Senator Feinstein for years, you know, and she said, look, there's a lot of, even before we have the high unemployment rates we have today, she says, we need to put local people to work. And we chronicled and had a lot of our growers that had the seasonal specialty crops, the perishable crops, go the welfare to work programs. They would go to their local employment development departments, and they would ask for workers to come out, and, you know, it just didn't work. Where you would maybe need 30 or 40 workers, you would maybe have 20 show up, and within an hour they all left. There was other ways for them to get their money other than coming out and picking fruit. And unfortunately, a lot of people do see it as, you know, entry-level work and demeaning work. And I don't know why. I grew up on a farm. To me, it's the only way to make a living. So we have relied on immigrant labor. Today, we know that since it's been 25 years since we had a program for folks to get a green card, just take a look at the average age of the worker and see how old they are, and there's a good chance that they don't have legal documentation. The problem for an employer is if someone comes to your farm and wants work, and you look at the Social Security card and it looks legitimate, you look at the ID and it looks legitimate, if you were to question that person, you would actually be breaking their civil liberties and could be brought up on charges of discrimination. So as an employer, you take a look at the Social Security card, you look at the ID, if everything looks legitimate, you go ahead and you put them on the payroll.
With the economic downturn, have farmers that you know seen an increase in Americans who are asking for farm work?
Nope, absolutely not. They just don't want to do that work today, and it's unfortunate, but that's just the reality of it. People do not want to go out and work in the fields.
This has been such an informative conversation. Thank you so much, Paul.
You bet.
That was Paul Wenger, the president of the California Farm Bureau. He joined us to talk about a recent bill titled E-Verify. Coming up, I've got a beer chick in the studio. Find out what some local craft brewers are doing to spice up their brews. That's next after this short break.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
This is KCRW and KCRW.com. Monday marks the beginning of LA Beer Week. The Misnomered Festival is actually a two-week celebration of craft brewing and beer drinking here in Southern California. One trend that I've noticed recently in our local craft brews is the addition of unique flavors. We've all had the orange slice served with a wit beer, implying the citrus flavor of a brew, but beer chick Christina Perozzi is here to share just how far modern brewmasters are going to create proprietary flavors. So let's start by talking about what the absolute necessary ingredients are to make a beer and have it be called legally beer.
Okay. To have it be called legally beer, you need four simple ingredients. Water, obviously. You need malts, which provide the fermentable sugars, and that's malted grain. It needs to be a grain. Can't be a fruit. If it's a fruit, it's a cider. And then you need yeast, which is the little single-celled organism that eats the fermentable sugars in the malt and creates alcohol and CO2. In order for it to be a beer, it also has to have hops, which is what provides the dryness and the grassiness and the bitterness that exists in beer. And that's what balances the sweetness from the malt.
So all of these craft brewers are starting out with these ingredients. And then it seemed like people started off, maybe this additive interest started off with maybe a little bit of spice. Coriander seems to be the first thing I started to remember seeing.
Yeah, well, the kind of the first originators of the clean, clear, sparkly beers were the Germans, were the Bavarians. And they actually had a German purity law. It was law called the Reinheitsgebot. I said it right. It was a law that prevented you from adding anything to beer besides those ingredients. And actually, yeast wasn't even named at that time. It was in 1516. They didn't know what yeast was. And so it was, you can only use water, you can only use malted barley and hops to make beer. And then whatever that yeast was, they called God is great, you know, God is good. They didn't know what it was, but something happened that made this beverage have you feel a little funny. That law really stopped people from adding things that might not be great in beer, you know, maybe using alternative sugar sources like beans or legumes or, you know, weird ingredients that might ferment but might make a very bad-tasting, off-flavored beer. But then from there, if you were outside of Germany, you could do whatever you wanted to. And those fancy Belgians started doing whatever they wanted, and they started adding spice. They started adding coriander. They had different malt sources because they were in different climates. And so maybe they would use wheat instead of malted barley, and then maybe they would add some coriander. Maybe they would add some bitter orange peel. And that's the style of beer known as wit beer. You know, that's one of the very first styles that kind of broke away from that Pilsner-style lager that everyone was a big fan of at the time.
And here in sort of the renaissance of craft beer making here in America, that became the first style that craft brewers seemed to experiment with, some of them going farther with the orange, some of them going farther with the coriander.
Yeah, I call that a gateway style. You know, a lot of people, their first foray away from the 90% of the, you know, mass marketed industrialized beers we have, their first step away will be a wit beer, a white ale. They'll be like, oh, this is great. And then that beer opens the door to a world of flavors that they didn't really know existed. So I think that white ale is a great way to do that. And I think a lot of brewers recognize that as well and would start experimenting with that. For instance, locally, Eagle Rock makes a wit beer called Manifesto. And they have the coriander and the orange peel, but then they also add rose petals.
It's really interesting. I mean, you mentioned Eagle Rock Brewing, and we were there one day together sharing some brews, and we drank a Stimulus, which had coffee bean.
Yes, Intelligentsia coffee, which was delicious. They use 75 pounds of Intelligentsia coffee when they're brewing this beer. And what's interesting about this beer is, you know, most people think coffee beers, they always think coffee stouts and coffee porters, and they think of a coffee, like an espresso. This will be like drinking a coffee. But what was interesting about Stimulus is that it was still a pale ale. You could still taste the pale ale qualities in it. So, you know, a lot of times coffee can be a very overpowering flavor. But because it wasn't roasted like a coffee, and because you weren't getting those dark beer, chocolate malt, roasty, bitter qualities that come along with a stout or a porter or something like that, the coffee was very
herbal
and bright, you know, and it wasn't overpowering and it worked with the hops. It was herbal. It was grassy. It was, you know, like, I don't want to say rosemary, but there was something in there that was very light and bright and refreshing and coffee and pale ale.
And you got to be relaxed and awake at the same time.
Yes. I was very aware that I was relaxed.
Now, there's a beer that I really love to have when I want something refreshing, but I need to actually go about my day and I can't have something that has too high in alcohol content. It's the Festiva
Pêche.
And that is so interesting to me because when you think about adding peach to a beer, often you'll think of a very sweet sort of pseudo-lambic style.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of people are doing that with fruit as well. There's a beer from Belgium called Scaldisch Pêchemel. It's made with peaches. It's a Belgian-style ale. You know, a lot of times when you get peach or you get fruit in beer, you get kind of a syrupy fruit. And this actually tastes and smells like fresh peaches, like you just picked it off the farmer's market table and bit into it along with your beer. I just think it's delicious. But people are doing that with fruit a lot now.
So what are some other additives that you are noticing people putting in beers that you find really add something, where it's not just a gimmick?
Right. Well, also, I say adjunct instead of additive, because additive can be a preservative.
It can be something negative.
Right, exactly. But an adjunct is seen as kind of that's something that's added, that's supplementary, that it's not necessarily, it would still be beer without the adjunct, but the adjunct adds something to enhance the beer. So that's how I like to look at it. I think that breweries are doing really interesting things with herbs now. We talked about the brewery and Placentia, but they are doing a beer with Thai basil. That I really, really love. It's called the Trade Winds Triple. It's delicious. It's a Belgian-style triple. I think it's about 8% alcohol. It's just really nice, clean, bright, and nice and herbaceous and a little minty. You know, it's really, really, really good.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here again.
Christina Perozzi, along with her partner, Hallie Bone, are the Beer Chicks. You can check out some of Christina and Hallie's top beer picks at the 8th Street Bottle Shop, carefully curated craft beer store featuring their favorite brews. We'll have a link to their website and to the shop on our website. Speaking of beer, Good Food is celebrating Oktoberfest at our next Good Food Happy Hour from 7 to 9 p.m. on October 20th at Beer Garden in Koreatown. If you haven't been to one of our happy hours, come on out and join me for discounted pints and a special menu. All the details are on my Facebook page. There are some things like beer that seem universally liked. Pizza, possibly French fries, and definitely naan, that puffy, bubbly, flaky Indian bread. What's not to like about it? If you're like me and don't have a tandoor in your home kitchen, don't despair. Artie Sequeira of the Food Network's Artie Party's here to tell us her secret to no-fail homemade naan. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you. This is such a milestone for me to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have you.
Thank you.
So naan is so interesting. I mean, I have my own bizarre technique for making it at home, but I'm so interested to hear your take on it.
Well, it's kind of funny because naan is not a bread that I grew up with. I am from the south of India, and naan is very much a North Indian bread. It kind of came through Afghanistan and Iran. I love it. Of course, I mean, just like you said, what's not to love? But we grew up with sort of whole wheat chapatis and parathas and things like that. So I had to learn how to make naan, just like I'm sure anybody that's listening does, just by trying every dang recipe that there is out there. Everyone's is slightly different. For me, I love the taste of yeast.
Do some people use other leaveners besides yeast?
I think traditionally it was just yeast, but in the years people have started doing baking soda, baking powder, combination of both and no yeast whatsoever. You know, I don't like the slightly metallic taste that you get from baking soda and baking powder.
Also, the mouthfeel is different. It isn't as springy.
Yeah. It's a little sort of soda bread-like, you know, and I love that sort of soft kind of invite you in for a hug thing that yeast does to the naan dough. So for me, I make a very simple naan dough. It's not very different from other ones out there, but I cook it on the stovetop. And the reason I do that is because I started it in the oven on the pizza stone or on a baking sheet. And I just found that they turned into these sort of hard cardboard discs, you know, that I could fling across the room if I wanted to hurt my husband, but not necessarily for eating. And so what I do is I take a cast iron skillet. I put the round of naan dough in, you know, heat it up really, really hot because, of course, a tandoor oven gets to 900 degrees. So let it go and, you know, slap the naan dough in there, wait until it sort of bubbles and chars on the one side, flip it over, and then here's the thing. You put a lid over the top of it. And it sort of steams it and kind of softens it. So it's not going to be exactly the same as your tandoor-made naan that you would find at a restaurant, but it's pretty dang close.
Let's talk about the dough for a minute, because before we got on the air, you were saying that there were some, when you published it on your blog, Arty Party, there were comments from some of your readers that the dough was, they thought the stickiness of the dough was a mistake.
Yeah, you know, and I think this is one of the joys of having an actual cooking show, because if you watch the episode, you can actually see how sticky it is. And I would never have allowed my dough to be that sticky. I would have thought, oh my gosh, it's too wet and it's not going to work. But I had watched a video online of a woman making it, an old auntie, and hers was very sticky. You could see her kind of prying it off her fingers. If it's not that sticky, it's not going to be flaky.
Because all of that moisture in the dough creates steam when it hits that hot heat, that heat.
And then the layers, you know, so the bread sort of opens up. And yeah, it's a really odd thing. So I hope that those people who tried it and didn't like it are listening. You know, give it another go. Of course, within reason. I mean, if you pour the dough onto your work surface and it goes, you know, all over it, then that's not a good dough. But it's got to be pretty sticky.
How does naan dough differ from other flatbreads? Is it the wetness?
I think it's the wetness and it's the yeast. For example, if you compare it to chapatis that I grew up with, that chapati dough is nothing more than whole wheat flour and water. That's it. A little bit of oil sometimes as well. But there's no leavening agent in it. So when chapati, if you've ever watched anyone make it or make it yourself, it does puff up. But that's just pure air that you've managed to kind of trap in there. But with the naan, that yeast gives it that extra pillowy quality.
A lot of naan recipes seem to add a little bit of dairy to the recipe, either yogurt or buttermilk. Do you do that?
I definitely add some yogurt to it. I think it keeps it soft. Anytime you add some buttermilk or some yogurt to a bread or even a cake, you find that the texture is really sort of, it's just a much more moist bread or cake. So I think the same thing is happening here in this naan dough. A little bit of yoga is fantastic.
Do you like to make different flavors, or are you a purist? Do you like the plain the best?
No, you know, I put nigella, sort of, they're not technically onion seeds, right? But they're very closely related. Nigella and fennel seeds in my naan dough, and I think it's fantastic.
When you take it off the stove, do you keep it plain, or do you brush it with a little butter?
Oh, definitely brush it with butter. I do. It's, you know, this is the cool thing about living in America, is you're exposed to these things that you wouldn't necessarily have known when you know, living in Dubai or India. I brush it with butter, and then I take some Maldon sea salt and sprinkle that over
top.
So it's kind of crunchy, salty. It's so good.
And what's your favorite thing to scoop with the naan?
I love, you know, it's not completely authentic, but a good chicken tikka masala and some naan is just a match made in heaven for me. That really sort of creamy, almost, you know, sweet and acidic sauce with the naan is just brilliant.
What is in chicken tikka masala?
So this is a funny dish that came about, rumor has it, during the Raj, during the British occupation of India or whatever. I don't want to use any political terms, but so it's an amalgamation of East meets West. It's the original fusion food, I think, where an Indian chef had to make for a general a curry. And so he took a can of cream of tomato soup, added some spices to it, threw some chicken in there, boomski, chicken tikka masala was born and is now, you know, some say the national dish of the UK. So it's just a very simple, creamy tomato sauce. I like to take my chicken and marinate it in some yogurt to tenderize it. Yogurt that has lots and lots of ginger and garlic in it. Then I grill it, both for the texture and for the flavor, and then throw it into this sort of spiced tomato sauce. And it really is so good.
That sounds perfect for dipping naan.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Arty.
Thank you for having me.
That was Arty Sequeira. She's the host of Arty Party on the Food Network and the author behind the blog of the same name. Her naan recipe is on the Good Food blog. Just like with Artie and her naan bread, when I'm developing a new recipe, it's really great to have a community of cooks and eaters to ask questions and request advice. On my Facebook page, you can do just that. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, click like, and join the conversation. Stay tuned. Jonathan Gold is up next with a restaurant suggestion that you won't want to miss. That's in 1 minute here on KCRW 89.9 FM and KCRW.com.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's that time of the show when Jonathan Gold comes to join us. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. This week, we're visiting the new brick and mortar from one of LA's most popular food trucks.
We are going to Little Tokyo. Not to a Japanese restaurant, but to the brand new Flying Pig Cafe.
And this, of course, is the phenomenon of a food truck opening a brick and mortar.
Right, which you think would have happened a lot, but usually trucks is trucks and restaurants is restaurants.
So what was Flying Pig known for on the truck, and how different is brick and mortar?
Flying Pig the truck was known for probably their pork belly buns. And pork belly buns, as you know, is like the signature dish of David Chang in the East Village of New York. He's practically made an empire out of his pork belly buns. In fact, he has. He has four restaurants and like hangs out with Rene Redzepi. So it's like, yeah, empire accomplished. And it's really nice to be able to get pork belly buns out of a truck.
Now, describe the bun. Is the bun like the Chinese dim sum bun?
You know, when you go to restaurants and get Beijing duck, sometimes you'll get the thin pancakes and sometimes you'll get those steamed buns that seem a little bit like, and in fact, I know it's actually, it's like a Chinese home cook truck to, you know, steam, heat and serve roll. and they're soft and they're slippery and they're folded over, you know, pork belly and, you know, a little bit of greens and a little bit of hoisin. It's a delicious thing.
But if they have a brick and mortar, have they gone beyond their menu that they have on the truck?
They have and they haven't. Yeah, obviously it's a bigger menu, and obviously they have specials. For example, one of the big things at the restaurant is the duck fried rice, which I assume is fried with duck, and there's bacon and little bits of shishito pepper in there and bits chopped shiitake mushrooms and brown rice. And it's in a weird way, it's like it tastes healthier than anything with both duck fat and bacon should ever taste.
It sounds delicious.
But it's a pretty good dish. And they do kakuni, which is the big, as you know, the big izakaya dish of simmered pork belly. And they, you know, cook it for a long time in, you know, soy and spices and probably wine. And then instead of just slipping it into a taco, they slice it more thinly and they put it over rice. And it's nice. It's good.
Are they open for lunch and dinner or just for lunch?
Yeah, they're open for lunch and dinner. So if you get if it's lunchtime and you get a hankering for the togarashi fries, and you probably should because who wouldn't want like french fries with togarashi sprinkled on them?
Describe what togarashi is.
It's like a sort of a crunchy Japanese spice mixture with a little bit of chili in it.
Chili, sesame seeds, little bits of nori, right?
Right.
Yeah, yum.
And a lot of the business is probably done as on the truck with their Asian tacos. So if you were a fan of their tamarind duck tacos with like little segments of mandarin orange in it, I mean, that was always my favorite thing for the Flying Pig truck. You can rest assured that you will be able to get your duck with mandarin orange tacos there too. Or they do this kind of pork sausage, and they cook it crispy, and It's not aggressively Asian spice, but it definitely has sort of that Asian spice that's very difficult to place where in Asia it's from, but it's sort of generically Southeast Asian, and it's really good, and you're happy it's in your taco with, you know, cilantro and whatever else is in there.
Anything else you'd like to highlight off the menu?
I would say that if you were thinking of getting the kimchi tofu burrito, probably don't. But if you were thinking of getting sweet potato fries or the sort of, you know, interesting seafood curry ramen, you know, what the heck? You only go around once.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Flying Pig Cafe in the heart of Little Tokyo in downtown LA. To find out the exact address, simply text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And I'll send you the address of the Flying Pig Cafe, and you'll get a list of Jonathan's favorite dishes. Don't forget, you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions also on our Good Food restaurant map, which lives on our blog, the Good Food Blog, of course. Last week on Good Food, I spoke to food writer Michael Ruhlman about his recent book, Ruhlman's 20. We talked about the 20 techniques that every home cook should know. This week, he joins me again to discuss one of the most vital ingredients in the kitchen, salt.
Typically, it enhances flavor. It enhances our ability to perceive flavor. It is a critical element in our body. Our bodies need it for nutrient exchange at the cellular level. We've learned to fear salt because nutritionists tell us that we have eaten too much salt and that salt is bad for us. Too much salt is bad for us, but if you eat natural foods, cook them yourself, you don't need to worry about salt levels. You can usually salt food to levels that are pleasing to you. So pay attention to what pleases you. But in a brine, it actually can take flavor into a muscle. There's much debate about this. And the eminent food scientist and authority, Harold McGee, says that flavor molecules are too big to get into the muscle. And I would hesitate to disagree with such a sage as Harold McGee, but I actually taste when I brine a chicken, in the rosemary brine chicken, the rosemary inside, in the interior of the flesh. So I'm certain that it can deliver flavor into the actual flesh somehow.
Let's talk about how certain techniques work. You have a note about when cooking salmon, often when you roast it, you'll get this sort of unattractive white glop that is drawn out of the fish onto the top. First of all, tell me what that is.
That's a protein that's albumin that is squeezed out of the muscle of the fish. And if you salt the fish ahead of time, either with a heavy dose that you wash off after 10 minutes or if you stick it in a brine, that albumin is actually set and solidified within the muscle so it doesn't squeeze out when you cook the fish.
That's so interesting. I mean, this for me is one of the most interesting things about how salt acts in food, how it affects texture.
It does. There is another great example is what it does to zucchini. It turns this sort of crisp, bland, sort of nothing vegetable into this very interesting, supple, moist vegetable simply by salting it for 10 minutes. It enhances flavor. It changes flavor. It cures food. It reduces the bacterial activity on food. It dehydrates bacteria so that they can't multiply. And it pulls water out of meat so that there's less bacterial activity even possible within the meat. It's how we cure salmon. It's how we cure bacon or ham.
It seems over the past, I'd say maybe 5 to 8 years that we see, it's not even a trend anymore, but we see the importance of salt in sweet foods, in baking and in pastry making. Why do you think that's happened, and what's your favorite way to use salt in something sweet?
My favorite use of salt is on caramel, is on sugar that's been melted and caramelized, and then to add salt to sugar. So you've got these two opposites, the salt and the sugar together, and they come together and form this sort of stunning pair, especially when it's on some delicious vanilla ice cream. So I love that sweetness. That use of salt on something that's so, so very, very sweet. And that's where we need salt most, and something that's so intensely sweet. French onion soup is a sweet soup. We add salt and acidity to balance it. It's all about balance. And I think that pastry chefs have just become more attuned to it, and they also like the surprise of it, that they've started talking about it a lot and using bacon, salty ingredients in their sweet things. That's another salt issue that we should talk about, is using salty ingredients, whether it's an anchovy or whether it's bacon, to add flavor and salt to what you're cooking to enhance it.
One of your favorite ways to add salt, in fact, is fish sauce, and not just for Asian ingredients, I understand.
God, fish sauce is just such a miracle to me. When my chef, Chef Pardis, who taught me to think in the kitchen, long ago at the Culinary Institute of America, he said, I add fish sauce to macaroni and cheese. And then when he said that, I thought, well, what can't you add it to? You really can add fish sauce to just about anything that you would add salt to. I wouldn't add it to ice cream. You don't want that umami flavor, but that's what it is. That's what you're getting when you're adding fish sauce to something. You get a really deep savoriness that may not already be there. Now, if you're using something else with umami, like Parmesan cheese or liver, say, or something that gives it something really deep savoriness, you don't need that fish sauce. But add it to onion soup, and it's great. Add it to macaroni and cheese. It's wonderful. Add it to just about anything you would otherwise add salt to, and it gives it just a depth that you wouldn't otherwise have. But you have to be careful. If you add too much, it's going to taste like fish sauce, and you don't want it to taste like fish sauce, because if you ever tasted that stuff, well, you wouldn't want to drink it.
Michael, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
That was Michael Ruhlman. We've been talking about salt. Michael's latest book is Ruhlman's 20. We'll have a link to it on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Don't go away. I've got more good food coming up after this short break.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Dan Capel joined us back in 2008 when his book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, first was published. In that book, Capel chronicled the dismal future for the Cavendish, the variety seen everywhere in America. He recently won a James Beard Award for his follow-up piece in Savour magazine. The banana's seen some changes in the last couple of years, and he joins us for an update. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. So the last time we spoke, Panama disease was wiping out whole plantations of the Cavendish, but it hadn't made its way to Latin America and South America. Has the disease spread or mutated at this point?
The disease has spread throughout much of the world, but happily it has not yet arrived in Latin America. It still could any day, given the nature of the disease. The biggest thing that's happened is that the banana companies, after years and years of silence and denial, have finally begun to worry about this and talk about it, and that's a big change.
Because the banana that we think of being the banana is a monoculture throughout the Western world, correct?
That's right. There's only one, and when you have just one banana and it gets sick, they're all clones of each other, and all the other ones get sick. And the banana industry has been working with monoculture for over 100 years.
You know, it's so interesting because when you travel outside of the United States, you see many different bananas.
Oh, yeah. There are 1,000 different banana varieties, all of which pretty much taste better than ours. And the banana companies would like you to believe that they've got this system that can only accommodate the Cavendish, the way McDonald's can only accommodate hamburgers. In a sense, that's true, but it's a system of their own making. And the answer to monoculture, as most people now know, is diversity. Can the banana companies make a system devoted to diversity? Of course they can. They're billion-dollar corporations.
Recently, you received a grant from the National Geographic Society to actually go out and look for new varieties of the fruit. How did you manage to do that, and where did you go?
Well, it's a bit of a long story, but basically, I had heard of an abandoned agricultural research station in the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, a former Belgian station that was abandoned in 1960 when Congolese independence was gained. I had also heard through a scientist who was still living, who worked there as a very young man, that he had bred some interesting bananas and that they were lost cultivars. So I wrote up a proposal to the National Geographic Expeditions Council and was shocked when they gave me the money to put the scientific team together. And we went out there and searched for these bananas.
Were you successful?
Yes and no. We did not find the bananas we were looking for. But what we did find was in the villages surrounding this very, very remote place, a lot of banana variety, way more than had been reported or studied or expected in tiny villages, up to 5, 6, 7, or even 8 kinds of bananas. And it was that insulating effect of having variety, having biodiversity, and not having a monoculture that made these villages thrive with bananas. And it was a lesson to us. And how these bananas got to these places took a lot of detective work, and it was fascinating, fascinating detective work.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, we saw bananas, this was Central Africa, that only should have been in Eastern Africa. Well, it turned out they had come through revolution. Invaders would come from the East, very recent times, and they would leave their bananas. We found a banana that probably originated in Thailand. It most likely was bought by Chinese mine workers in the early 1900s. So there is this diversity from just human movement, which actually mirrors the movement of the banana over 3,000 years. But sometimes these tragedies, like war, which was a really terrible thing, actually helped insulate the local, less diverse banana crop.
Do banana plants, when left on their own devices, cross-pollinate?
They don't, because bananas are seedless and pollenless for the most part. They're sterile. And so occasionally what you'll see is a mutation. And it's believed that our seedless bananas are the result of a 10,000-year-old mutation. But you don't see a lot of pollination. It has to be done by humans. The human hand is what creates the banana in this world.
So what are the banana companies afraid of? Do other varieties of bananas that you've seen out there in the world, do they ripen differently than the Cavendish? Would they require different types of management to get them to us in that sort of pristine yellow condition that we expect?
Absolutely. There are about 30 separate criteria to make a good commercial banana, besides some obvious ones like it can't ripen too fast because you don't want a rotten banana at your supermarket. For example, banana trees for industrial farming have to be a certain height because that makes them more resistant to hurricanes. Bananas need to get yellow in a way that is predictable to us so we know when they're ripe. Some delicious bananas don't turn yellow, so how do we know how to use it? Now, the banana companies pretty much have stuck to these criteria, and I like to see them in a way like sort of like Kodak. There's a new world out there, and they haven't figured it out, and somebody is going to if they don't.
Describe a couple of the interesting banana varieties that you found when you were on this trip.
So I'll tell you two, one of which was the Gros Michel, which is the banana that is functionally extinct that our Cavendish replaced. That banana is actually living in gardens in Africa and in other places. And the reason it can survive, even though the disease is in the soil, is because it is insulated by diverse crops. And it's everyone's told me, oh, it's better than the Cavendish, and I never had the opportunity to taste one. And it was, but not a lot better. The banana that was the best was called Ibota Ibota, which is Swahili for fertile, fertile, which means it produces bunches of 20, 30, even 40 bananas on a single hand. These are small bananas with the only way you could describe the taste is complex. It's one bite and it's sour. The next bite it gets sweet. Taste explosion in your mouth. Your taste buds are dancing. It's a great banana, the best I've ever had. It looks familiar, but the texture is creamy. It's imagine the horrible taste of ultra-pasteurized heavy cream compared to the fresh, real stuff. That's what you've got with the Ibote Ibota.
What countries have the most varieties, and why don't we see those other varieties here?
India is the most banana-rich country on Earth. They have over 600 of the world's 1,000 varieties, and people are very, very adamant about how much they love their village banana. And how adamant about how much they hate our Cavendish, which is, it's called the hotel banana in India.
I love that.
Why they haven't been brought here, I just think it's, this corporate thinking, they haven't done it. India has a great entrepreneurial culture. It also has great banana research. I think the next banana is going to come from India, bypassing Chiquita and Dole. That's my personal opinion.
Here in Southern California, where's the best place for us to go to taste a wider variety than we would find in a normal supermarket?
You can grow your own, and you can get breeding stock. There's a couple of nurseries near San Diego. I would suggest that anyone who is interested in that, it's not hard to do, go to bananas.org, which is the Banana Growers Club online, and you'll get more advice than you could ever imagine.
And is it easy to grow them here?
Pretty much. If you have enough water and the right shade conditions, it'll grow. It's harder to get good fruit out of them. You have to practice. But if you have patience, I think you can.
This has been such an interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dan Capel, the author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. We've been talking about his latest trip to the Congo, where he went looking for new banana varieties. Bananas aren't the only crop that's struggling. Iowa cornfields have also been hit with an infestation of bugs that are wreaking havoc on this year's crop. What's unique about this infestation is that the bugs are attacking a type of corn that was genetically modified to resist them. Dr. Aaron Gassman, an entomologist at Iowa State University, is here to explain.
Well, these plants were genetically modified to resist the western corn rootworm, which is a major pests of corn in much of North America.
And how long have farmers been growing the crop?
This particular type of genetically modified corn has been grown since 2003.
So what research were you conducting to make this discovery?
Well, we responded to calls from farmers and people who work with farmers by scouting their fields and providing pest management assistance. They were observing high levels of rootworm feeding and rootworm abundance in these genetically modified cornfields. The species had begun responding to the selective pressure imposed on it by the corn plant. In other words, the corn plant is very effective at killing the pest, and as a result, that places pressure on the pest population to develop a way to circumvent this strategy, in essence, for the pest population to develop resistance.
So if they first started using the plants in 2003 and you discovered these worms in 2009, it took about 6 years for the worms to start to modify themselves so that they could survive that stress.
Yeah, it's just a natural evolutionary process that's happening. And one of the common patterns we observed is that these fields where farmers were having issues with controlling the pest using the genetically modified corn, those fields had been planted to the same type of genetically modified corn for at least 3 years. So three consecutive seasons during which the pest population was then exposed to the same type of genetically modified corn.
It must have been pretty surprising for the farmers to find that, I mean, they had bought this special seed so that they would be shielded from this kind of pest. And then to discover their fields infested with it must have been disappointing, to say the least.
I think it was disappointing. I don't know if it was surprising. I mean, anyone who works for a long time in agriculture becomes accustomed to the idea that pests will develop resistance, you know, whether it's weeds developing resistance to herbicide or insects developing resistance to conventional insecticides. It's part of a larger pattern we see where, you know, if a pest population is continually challenged by a control agent, eventually it will develop resistance.
For pest management in the fields, it seems like now that this has happened, it sort of means that they're going to start a different cycle of experimentation to resist bugs? Or do they just go back to the old-fashioned crop rotation system?
Well, there are other types of transgenic corn that are on the market. If, you know, they like the particular transgenic hybrid they're using, it, you know, may still have some effectiveness. Perhaps they can combine it with a soil-applied insecticide. They could use more crop rotation. I think that would be very desirable. One of the common patterns we were seeing here in areas where problems were arising was reliance on just one particular strategy to manage the pest, and reliance on that strategy over several consecutive years. And I think that a way to avoid this problem in the future is to use more of the available strategies and to integrate those strategies, so to have a more diversified approach to management. I think it's important to keep in mind that typically when a pest develops resistance to something, it often comes at the expense of greater vulnerability to other environmental conditions. So if a resistant insect and a susceptible insect are, say, competing with each other existing in the wild in the absence of the control strategy that one pest has become resistant to, the susceptible pest will usually be more fit.
Wow, very complex and very interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Gassman.
My pleasure. It was very good talking with you.
Dr. Aaron Gassman is an entomologist at Iowa State University. We've been talking about Western corn root worm. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, Becky Nelson, and Becky Gephardt. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.